state.
Welcome to Akhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhatra AI.
Hello and welcome. Today we're diving into what I think is one of the most structurally ambitious and just profoundly moving novels of the last few decades, David Mitchell's 2004 masterpiece, Cloud Atlas.
It really is. And if you've heard of it, you know it's a puzzle box. If you've tried reading it, you know that puzzle and feel, well, a little intimidating at first.
Right, but that complexity is the whole point.
Exactly. I mean, Mitchell wasn't just writing six separate stories. He was building what some people call an uber novel. He wanted to show how every single human action, no matter how small, just resonates across centuries. It's not literary showing off. It's a deeply humanist project.
And that's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to unpack that audacious structure, pull it apart, and really get to its philosophical core, this idea of a constant struggle between predation and compassion. So for you listening, think of this as a map to navigate a brilliant literary maze. We want to turn that complexity into clarity. And to do that, we have to start with the architecture, because really it defines everything. Mitchell structures the book as a palindrome, A, B, C, D, E, F, and then back out, E, D, C, B, A.
A perfect mirror. So you get six stories, each one nested inside the next, like a Russian doll, until you hit that center, the keystone, story F. Then you travel back out, and you get the second half of all those stories you left hanging. You finally get the resolutions.
And the genius is how he connects them. It's not just a clever trick. It's the engine of the whole novel's meaning. Each protagonist, in their own time, literally finds and reads a document, a journal, a letter, a manuscript from the character in the previous era.
So it's a physical chain of influence.
A literal documented chain. It completely attacks the idea that we're all just isolated individuals. It makes you ask, you know, is my life really my own? Or am I just bound by the echoes of people who lived ages ago?
And there's that spiritual layer, too, with the recurring comet-shaped birthmark on several characters. It hints at this idea of a single soul, or maybe a moral archetype, being reincarnated through time.
It absolutely does. It connects them all, like different soloists in that musical piece from the book, The Cloud Atlas Sextet. So to really get the payoff, we have to do the ascent. Let's walk through those first five half-lives.
Okay, let's start with A. We're at 1849 with Adam Ewing's Pacific Journal. The style feels like this old archaic travel diary. Ewing is a pretty naive American notary. He's sailing home, and he's just morally blind to the horrors of colonialism he's witnessing.
But he's starting to wake up. His connection with Atua, a Moriori slave who's a stowaway on the ship, is the beginning of his moral journey. It's a story about dawning empathy.
But just as that's happening, the story cuts off. We leave Ewing being slowly, methodically poisoned by his travel buddy, the supposedly friendly Dr. Henry Goose. It's such a powerful opening statement on predation hiding behind civility.
And that very literal act of violence then transforms. We leap forward to 1936 to Story B, Robert Frobisher's Letters from Zettelgum. Frobisher is this charming, ambitious, broke young composer. He's bisexual, running from debt, and frankly from conventional life.
The whole tone shifts, doesn't it? It becomes this, like, jazz age artistic drama.
Completely. He's working for this older, famous composer, Vivian Ayers. And while he's there, what does he find? Ewing's old, dusty journal.
The chain begins.
But his story is about a different kind of predation artistic theft. He creates his masterpiece, the Cloud Atlas Sextet, but Ayers, his mentor, plans to steal it. The narrative breaks right as Frobisher realizes he's trapped. Intellectual predation, it turns out, is just as deadly as poison.
From there, the genre shifts again, and so does the pace. Story C, Louisa Ray in 1973. This is a full-on, high-stakes conspiracy thriller.
Yeah, it is. Ray is this incredibly tenacious journalist in California. She meets an old man, Dr. Rufus Sixsmith, and here's the link. He was Frobisher's lover from decades before.
Wow.
He tips her off to a deadly conspiracy at a nuclear power plant. So Frobisher's emotional legacy through Sixsmith becomes this chain of information that drives Ray's quest for justice. The predation here is corporate, bureaucratic, and it poisons a whole society.
And the break is just brutal. It happens mid-action. Her car is run off a bridge, and you're left hanging, literally wondering if justice just died with her.
From that life or death moment, we are thrown into a completely different mood. Story D, Timothy Cavendish in the early 2000s.
This one is pure black comedy. Cavendish is this vain, kind of pathetic publisher in Britain. He's on the run from gangsters, and his own brother tricks him into a nursing home.
Aurora House. And it's hilarious until it's suddenly terrifyingly oppressive. He's trapped in this little micro-dystopia run by the monstrous nurse Noakes. But the past finds him, too. He's reading a manuscript of Louisa Ray's story.
So her story becomes his escape.
And his call to action. The story cuts off right as he decides he and the other residents have to fight for their freedom.
Which brings us to the final step of the ascent. Isan Mai 451 in the year 2144. We're in full dystopian sci-fi now. Neo-Socophros, a futuristic Korea.
Mm-hmm. And Sonmi is a fabricant. She's a genetically engineered clone, basically, created for slave labor in a fast food restaurant. Her life is meant to be short and disposable.
But her story is about ascension, an awakening.
It's a literal awakening of consciousness. A revolutionary helps her escape and shows her the real world, forbidden art, forbidden history. And what does she watch? A film based on Timothy Cavendish's ordeal.
That's incredible. His farcical escape becomes a lesson in human dignity for her.
It does, and her story breaks just as she joins the rebellion, ready to deliver a message that could shatter her entire world.
So after all that, we finally land at the novel's core. Story F's Lucius Crossan and everything after.
Yeah.
This is the keystone, right? The only story that isn't broken in half.
Which is so important. It's the only whole life we get to see in one go. And it's set centuries after the fall, some kind of apocalypse. We're in a tribal, post-literate Hawaii.
And the language completely changes. It's this broken, phonetic, pidgin English. It really forces you to slow down.
It does. You have to experience the world through the eyes of our protagonist, Zachary. And his world is steeped in fear. He's constantly fighting this voice in his head he calls Old Georgie, which is just his own cynicism and cowardice.
And that theme of predation we've been tracking comes back in its most primal form, cannibalism. His people, the Valleysmen, are hunted by the Kona tribe.
His whole journey is a test. He has to guide Marinim, who is one of the last technologically advanced humans, a prescient up a sacred mountain. It's a battle against his fear, against Old Georgie.
And at the top of that mountain is the big reveal. The Cloud Atlas Station.
Right. It's an old satellite observatory. And there, Marinim shows him holographic recordings of Sanmai 451. Zachary's people worship Sanmai as a goddess, but Marinim shows him the truth. She was a mortal woman.
And those recordings, they're humanity's last message broadcast into space before civilization collapsed. The story just becomes cosmic at that point. You realize this future was born from all the failures and small victories of the five stories that came before it.
Exactly. And when Zachary's village is attacked, he finally makes a choice. He fights alongside Marinim, rejecting Old Georgie's fear. He survives, and he becomes the storyteller, passing all these histories down to his son on a new world. He becomes the vessel for human memory.
Okay, so we've reached the summit. Now we begin the descent, going back out from E to A, and we finally get that satisfaction of seeing how everything resolves.
And returning to Sanmai 451, E is heartbreaking. We learn her entire rebellion was a sham orchestrated by the state to create an enemy and justify their own power.
But her story still wins, in a way.
It does. Her power isn't in winning the fight. It's in her final testimony, her orison. That recording escapes, and it's what becomes the sacred text for future people like Zachary. The story itself becomes her legacy.
Then we get back to Timothy Cavendish D, and it's just pure, joyful payoff. We see the geriatric escape from Aurora House, and it's hilarious, but also so profound.
It is. Cavendish goes from this coward to a man who appreciates freedom, and he turns his horrible experience into a screenplay. The art redeems the suffering.
The pace really picks up now. Louisa Ray's story.
See, she survives the crash, gets the report, and she even finds a copy of Frobisher's Cloud Atlas Sextet. She succeeds. She brings down the corrupt corporation. It's one of the few clean victories in the whole book.
And then Robert Frobisher.
Back to Robert Frobisher, B. He finishes his masterpiece, the Sextet, but he knows he's trapped by heirs. He chooses suicide, but on his own terms. His death ensures his music survives him, making him immortal.
And finally, we close the loop, all the way back to Adam Ewing.
He's saved by Atua, the slave he helped. Atua reveals Dr. Goose's poisoning plot. Ewing returns home a completely changed man. He confronts his slave-trading father-in-law and declares he's joining the abolitionist cause. The chain of kindness is finally complete.
So after that incredible journey, what's the big takeaway? All these mechanics, this structure, what's the philosophy behind it?
Well, the most obvious theme is just the terrifying persistence of predation. That mantra, the weaker meat and the strong do eat, echoes through every single era.
Right. It's literal cannibalism for Zachary, slavery for Ewing, corporate greed for Ray. It's the same hunger, just in different clothes.
But the novel's counterargument is interconnectedness. It works almost like a law of karma. And Mitchell makes it explicit through Sanmi. She says, and this is really the thesis of the whole book, our lives are not our own. From womb to tomb, we are bound to others, past and present, and by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future.
It's such a powerful idea.
Yeah.
And the vehicle for that connection, the thing that carries consciousness through time, is art. Storytelling.
Absolutely. Art is the only true immortality in the novel. A journal inspires letters, which inspire a piece of music, which influences a thriller manuscript, which becomes a film, which survives as a sacred text. These stories are the containers that carry empathy across the abyss of time.
And it all culminates in that quiet, final, defiant statement from Adam Ewing. His father-in-law tells him that fighting slavery is pointless, that he's just one drop in an endless ocean of evil.
And Ewing's reply just ties the whole novel together. He says, "Yet what is any ocean but a multitude of drops?"
It's the ultimate defense of individual moral action, no matter how hopeless things seem.
And that's what stays with you. Cloud Atlas forces you to see your own life as just one link in a vast chain, which I think compels you toward a greater sense of responsibility to both the past and the future.
Which leaves you with a really unsettling final question to mull over.
Mm-hmm.
Are we, as a species, actually getting better? Or are we just finding more sophisticated technological disguises for the same old sins? This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.